Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Art Sear of Carthage College, Mike Miller of DePaul University, Mark Witte of Northwestern University, and Nick Kakaroubis of DePaul University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And in the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about the fiscal cliff that is before this country. And we'll also be talking about Israel and the Palestinian state and Benghazi and Susan Rice and foreign policy in hour number two. But we begin with the oft-mentioned fiscal cliff that we are nearing in this country as Republicans and Democrats sort of figure out how they're going to mark their turf, allegedly go in and try to protect their bases and try to solve some of the fiscal problems that the country faces. If you watched television today, this morning, the Sunday shows, it was pretty hard to miss Timothy Geithner, who is the Treasury Secretary. He was on, and here are some of the things that he had to say on a variety of shows. He was talking about the Republicans. There's just no reason why 98% of Americans have to see their taxes go up because some members of Congress on the Republican side want to block tax rate increases for 2% of the wealthiest Americans. Remember, those tax rates, those tax cuts cost $1 trillion over 10 years. He went on to say, those rates are going to have to go up. That's an essential part of a deal. It is a decision that lies in the hands of the Republicans, who are now opposing an increase in those tax rates. The ball absolutely is in the Republicans' court to specify alternatives. And talking about the Republicans, they understand that, and when they come back to us and say, we want you to consider this and we'd like you to consider that, we'll take a look at that as well. That's Timothy Geithner on a variety of shows today. John Boehner only appeared on one show. That was Fox Sunday News. But here is what the House Speaker had to say. He said, quote, right now, I would say we're nowhere, period. We're nowhere. We've put a serious offer on the table by putting revenues out there to try to get this question resolved. But the White House has responded with virtually nothing. I don't want any part of going over the cliff. And then talking about his recent visit with Geithner, he said, I was flabbergasted. I looked at him and said, you can't be serious. I've just never seen anything like it. You know, we've got 7 weeks between Election Day and the end of the year, and 3 of those weeks have been wasted with this nonsense. And then he goes on to say he dismissed the administration's offer as a non-serious proposal. So pretty strong fighting words on each side, and I'd like to get response because we have a couple of economists with us this evening and some general political professors as well are going to be looking into this. So let me begin with you, Mike Miller, DePaul University. You're an economist. Let's talk about the politics of this first, then we'll get into the specifics of it.
Okay.
The war on words that are going on right now, what would you say to those that would say the American people, they voted for Barack Obama. They heard him say for 2 campaigns that he thinks the wealthiest of the wealthy aren't paying their fair share. Why shouldn't those people making above $250,000 accept the fact that their taxes are going up?
If you want to raise the tax burden that the rich pay, there's 2 ways to go about it. One would be to cut the deductions. The second would be to raise the rates. If only they cared about the revenue as opposed to the redistribution, I think we could get somewhere. Because you can raise revenue without necessarily raising tax rates by changing the deductions.
Mark Witte, your response from Northwestern University. You, too, are an economist. Your response.
Well, when you're talking about redistribution, that's whenever you raise revenues, you're redistributing. cutting back on the deductions, that's a good thing to do. Raising rates, unfortunately, will probably also be necessary. And when you cut back on deductions, you are raising rates for many people because mm-hmm. you're starting where they pay the next higher rate.
What in your view, Art Sear, let me ask you this. What in your view were the American people trying to say when they reelected Barack Obama and they reelected a Republican Congress? Is it just the general schizophrenia of the voter?
They reelected the Republican House. Democrats actually did better in the Senate, and
the Democrats actually got more votes in the House.
Why don't you speak then? Whenever you're done, Professor.
All right, I'm done.
Okay, go ahead, Art.
Yeah, I think that was a very good point the professor made, and I look forward to hearing more when he's speaking. The American electorate is very highly divided, and I think that ideological difference was reflected. Additionally, the Democrats, a huge change from the era of Reagan and Bush 1. The Democrats, starting with the Clinton administration and greatly reinforced currently, I think are the better organizers around the country.
Nick Kacharubas also joins us. Nick, nice to have you with us. Thank you very much. It's Kacharubas. I think I screwed it up in the opening, but nice to have you with us. Your reaction to the politics of this before we get into the economics of it?
Well, I think what I was saw this week, particularly, obviously the Republicans realized that the Democrat Barack Obama's message carried through with the voters. And I think we saw a move that we didn't see pre-election, saying that we're willing to put revenues on the table. What that exactly
Bader
means...
Bader said that almost from the get-go.
Yeah, what that exactly means, we have yet to say. But I think that that's a strong signal from the Republican Party that they heard the message that we can't just keep doing what we've been doing.
Mike?
Yeah, I agree. One thing
somebody's
about
got to move here. Who's going to blink?
I think Mr. Obama has got to blink. If the Republicans are offering a way to get more revenue and one that also does not that does not hurt incentives, because at higher rates, we economists think at the margin, the incentive is negative. If you keep raising rates, you're going to have a negative outcome in terms of incentives. So if we could just be more, I guess I'll use the word fair, in terms of the deductions, in terms of the mortgage deduction and the fact that we pay no taxes on our health care premiums and so forth, these kinds of things could raise a lot of money from a lot of people. See, the middle class would be paying those taxes as well. This would raise a lot of revenue.
But when anyone gets to a specific about doing away with the mortgage deduction or doing away with charitable deductions, it seems to me that that's going to cut across all political lines, both Republicans and Democrats, and people are going to cry bloody murder. But is there any way to make these numbers work without doing something that might be viewed as very unpopular, Mark?
Well, Peter Diamond talks about how there's a illusion that we've got let's see if I can get this right, a fiscal crisis and a jobs problem. But what we really have is a jobs crisis and a fiscal problem. In the long run, the fiscal problem, well, in the medium run, the fiscal problem's okay. In the long run, it's getting a little bit tough. And I think the way to get rid of these sort of loopholes and deductions is a 20-year phase out. That, a little bit every year, and after 20 years, the home mortgage deduction is gone.
I want to find out about that, and when we come back, 1-800-723-8029. We've already got people on the line. They want to weigh in. It's your future. It's the country's future. They're debating it in Washington right now. We're debating it tonight on Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8029. From Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Let's head to calls early in the broadcast this evening. Let's head to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where Ed is listening to us on WOWO, W-O-W-O. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. I suggest that maybe the Republicans ought to give the Democrats whatever they want fiscally. When it comes to vote on it, they just abstain. Let the Democrats vote for it. Let the Democrats own it. Democrats hang themselves with the rope.
Nick, what do you think of that strategy?
Well, I think, unfortunately, you need more than that to pass the vote.
Right.
So your Republicans aren't going to abstain. And also, they have a duty of being elected to not abstain. But I do think that I agree with the caller in the sense that I think the Democrats, in lieu of the president, should take the leadership in this negotiation. I really think it's – you know, we've heard from Speaker Boehner earlier and his kind of caving a little bit and revenues, putting revenues on the table. But I think it's Obama's court to really put the ball in play.
Well, I think I don't know if it was caving, although, you know, obviously his opponents might say caving. I mean, it was an olive branch. It was within 24 hours after the election. The voters did speak. But again, you know, Boehner, when he was on Fox today, he also reminded the president that, you know, the Republican House was reelected, too. So that is part, an integral part of how things get done. Now, again, last week when Boehner met and Eric Cantor, the majority leader, they met with Timothy Geithner. And at that meeting, that's when the Treasury Secretary provided some specifics, at least as a broad proposal for what the administration wants to propose. Again, it was nothing new, but again, basically, let's take a look at what that plan was. The Obama plan calls for $1.6 trillion in new revenue from upper-income taxpayers. It's $600 billion in reduced spending for Medicare, Medicaid, farm subsidies, and other programs. That was discussed during the recent campaign. $1 trillion in other spending cuts over 10 years that basically were agreed to last year in the grand bargain that never got voted on, or at least Boehner was not able to deliver the votes, and then $800 billion reduction in projected war spending that obviously is going in the opposite direction. So let's take a look at just some of those points. Again, Mike, we'll start with you. As a broad plan, which part of those 4 points do you agree with, and which ones don't you agree with?
Well, I see he wants $1.6 trillion worth of revenue from upper income. I just don't think the money is there. I don't know if it's $160 billion a year for 10 years, or is it 9 years, which would make it about $180 billion. I don't think there's $180 billion there. I don't think that the rich make enough money that you add 3 or 4 percentage points to the tax that you're going to get that kind of money.
Mark, do you agree with that?
Congressional Budget Office thinks it works, and I don't know, they're smarter than me. I'll take them at their word.
By just changing it from 36 to 39.5 plus the Obama extra tax, that's going to raise $1.6 trillion. Of course, that assumes it's got to be static, because that is assumed that no one will try to avoid those taxes, that the economy will continue to grow. And we know that one of the problems you were mentioning about this job problem, that if you take the current rates and apply them like we did, say, to 2007, the last year of the Bush administration, we had a budget deficit of 1.2% of GDP under the current rates. If you take the Americans who are currently unemployed and get them jobs and get them working, there'll be plenty of money. That's why I would focus more upon the deductions, which we should have done a long time ago, as opposed to the rates.
Do you like that? What about your thoughts? I want to get your response, Nick. What do you think of the idea of phasing this in over 10 to 20 years, as Mark suggested beforehand? Because these are going to be big shocks to people.
Well, I think that phasing them in would be fine. I think that the American people have spoken, in the sense that people want to see richer folks paying more. And so that concept is there. Obviously, nobody themselves want to pay more. We all like to pass the buck, so to speak. But I think conceptually that will make sense. I think where the rub comes is when it comes to deductions. I mean, I don't think the American people are going to give those things up.
Well, that's why there has been no specifics. So that's my question is, mm-hmm. when you go on and you explain that there's going to be that these deductions that people are used to, you're ready to jump in.
I was just going to say, in terms of the one way to get around that, I do agree with the phase out, certainly because of its effect upon the housing market. But in terms of, say, the mortgage deduction, you would not affect your average household if you put a limit as opposed to getting rid of it completely. So you say you can't deduct more than, I'll make up $50,000. Now, I don't have anywhere near $50,000, and I do okay. So we would be talking about people with very large homes, or 2 or 3 homes. So you would go after them first, and you would slowly phase that in, and the housing market would begin to adjust over time. And then we would recognize that the housing market is a market like every other, and it's not being dramatically influenced by government policy.
And what impact do you think there would be on charitable giving? living, Art. You're with the college that,
right.
that all, everyone is with the college at this table or our guests this evening. People they expect people to continue to give to colleges or to museums. What happens if the incentive for people to give is taken away by not being able to deduct your donation? What's going to happen?
That's really a good question. Not
Thank
that you,
you
ask bad questions, host, but no, it's a very good question. I was working at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations back in the 80s. When Secretary of the Treasury Baker in the Reagan administration orchestrated enormous tax reform, very effective in that era, a lesson for us. And there was a lot of concern by organizations like ours and educational institutions that the drastic reduction in charitable incentives would really hurt. It didn't, and especially in the boom of the 80s. The only detectable change was among very young people with very high incomes, which means celebrity sports figures, Hollywood act, very, very successful entertainers, and people with inherited wealth. But across the board, Americans are, have been, and I'm confident will be, extremely generous. That's yeah, a very good question.
They don't need the deduction.
It has a marginal impact, not in the economist sense, but in the real sense. It's nominal, and it shows just how generous this country is. I mean, our giving record is fantastic if you actually look at it. I think conservatives should talk about that more.
Nick?
I agree with that. Having worked in the nonprofit field myself, I think the vast majority of Americans don't really care about the charitable gift deduction. They don't take it to the extent they will. I think where it will affect is in the bequests and the large gifts, which can the world work without that? Certainly.
But that hasn't happened. I worked at the Ford Foundation back in the 70s, which I mentioned only because they were the biggest in the world and are still one of the biggest, but the growth of philanthropies,
even though
the tax reforms of the 80s reduced incentives, is just incredible.
That's correct.
By this country. We're very, very generous, and again, Republicans especially ought to talk about, they got to get out of the doghouse.
Mike?
They should talk about it more.
Yeah, if you look at what my understanding is of the economic research is that you look at the Reagan years when we had this dramatic change in tax rates and the Clinton years when it went up, there was no change in the giving. The thing that apparently are the two major determinants are income and net wealth. How wealthy are you and how much money do you make? And when those things are going up, people give regardless of what the tax consequences are.
Let's go to Mike listening in St. Joe, Michigan on WLS. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hey, I've just got a question. President Obama wants everybody to pay their fair share. I've got a 1-1-1 plan. And the plan is you raise the rate, the tax rate on everybody by 1%. So the millionaires, and there's a big discrepancy between million and billion and 250,000. So everybody pays 1%. If you're making $1 billion, you pay 1% more on $1 billion. And if you're making $40,000 a year, you pay 1% on $40,000. But then in turn, the people that aren't paying the taxes, well, then you reduce the rate of their government handout by 1%.
Oh.
Okay, so now we have
you've offered this is a new idea. We're going to go around the table. We're going to let everybody comment on it as economic policy and as political likelihood. Mark Witte, we'll start with you.
Well,
what would happen? How does his math work?
I don't know how much revenue would raise, but this sort of implication that people either pay taxes or get handouts is mistaken, that there are a lot of people in an intermediate case where they're not paying income taxes, but they're paying payroll and all sorts of other taxes. And a lot of people who are paying income taxes are also getting handouts, like those of us with mortgages are getting a subsidy for borrowing.
So do you think it's a good idea?
I think we need more revenue, and I think that's a way to do it.
What do you think of that idea, Art?
Sounds
1% for everybody.
Sounds like taxing everybody the same, which I don't think will fly politically, especially in the Obama era. Secondly, one of the programs to help the poor that's actually worked, I think a lot worked, but one that's worked dramatically is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which has really generated real income for the poorest people who work. And if I understand the plan right, that would have a negative impact on that. Finally, the flat tax, suggested by Steve Forbes, we can assume in the top 1% on Earth, perhaps, certainly in the U.S. in terms of income. That has been a non-starter for many years now, so Nick, I'm skeptical.
I think as an idea, it has merit to look at. Like you said, we're looking for revenues. We're looking for also decreases in expenditures. Politically, I think it would just dive on. I don't think there's any future.
Nobody would introduce it.
Got to see the numbers, like Mark said, and I'm not convinced this would generate enough to do much of anything with a $1 trillion deficit.
Sometimes you never see the numbers in politics.
That's right. Whose numbers?
You just vote up or down with the numbers are irrelevant.
We were discussing Lyndon Johnson off the air.
1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much. If you have an idea on how the government can avoid riding off the fiscal cliff, give us a call. 1-800-723-8029. Again, I think another point is if you are a recipient of any kind of government support, would you be willing to give any of it up, even a small percentage? Back to you. Back in Chicago, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to get back to calls at 1-800-723 in just a moment after I introduce our guests. So Mark Witte is here. He is a distinguished senior lecturer and director of the undergraduate studies program at the Department of Economics at Northwestern University, the Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. And by the way, didn't you your department won an award recently for... Was it the Fed Challenge?
Yeah. Oh, boy. Just on Tuesday, I was meeting with Bernanke, and the team did great, and we won.
Really? Wow. Now, what did you have to do to win that?
Well, what did I have to do, or
what did the team have to do?
I had to book some flights and things like that. that the team had to do a five-minute presentation about what they thought the state of the economy was and what appropriate reaction by the Fed would be, and then they had to put up with 15 minutes of hard questioning from Fed governors and Fed economists, and then they were judged versus other teams, and there's a lot of luck that goes into it, but they did a great job, and we're judged the winners.
Congratulations. Also with us this evening is Nick Kacharubas. He is a visiting assistant professor at DePaul University, and also he practices in that he is the city clerk of Crystal Lake, Illinois.
That's correct.
So do you practice what you preach? You teach politics, and then you have to engage in it.
I do. It's a nonpartisan role.
How long have you been at DePaul?
I've been there. This is my first year, so I've been enjoying it. I've been city clerk actually 4 years, and so and that's a part-time role, so I've been enjoying both.
Art Sear also joins us, one of the veteran members of the Beyond the Beltway team. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at the Clawson Center. That's at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, formerly with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, and as you said many years ago, with the Ford Foundation, pride of Hollywood, California.
Well, I don't know about the last point.
Well, Hollywood. Yeah. You went to Hollywood High, right?
Yeah, I went to UCLA.
UCLA. So right.
Thanks for the plug.
PhD from Harvard University.
Thank you, Bruce.
Also joining us this evening is Michael Miller. He is an assistant professor of economics in the Department of Economics, also at DePaul University, a graduate from Pittsburgh, hails from Pittsburgh. And, you know, I was doing a little research, and, you know, I don't know whether you know if you are a student or you have college students, they have a thing that's now on the web. It's called Rate Your Professor. and I decided, you know, I'm gonna look Mike up, and I only did it for Mike this week. But here's what it said: Professor Miller is very articulate, simplifies things very well, and overall does a great job teaching. The next person, one of the best professors I've had at DePaul. I learned more in his class than I've ever taken at any other professor. He has an effective and systematic teaching style. By the way, they didn't think you're necessarily an easy grader. By far, my favorite economics professor.
Wow. Geez, for an economist to get that out.
So you get rave reviews.
Yeah.
Now, when you see these things, do you try to track who these people down and you figure out what grade you get?
No.
But again, rave reviews.
Thank you, Bruce.
Let us go back to calls. Let's go to Joanne. She's listening to us in Schaumburg, Illinois on WLS. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for taking my call. I would just like to get the reactions from your guest tonight about a certain tax thing. But before I do that, one of your guests said something about, you know, counting on the Congressional Budget Office's figures.
Mm-hmm.
We know how they messed up with Obamacare. They came in under $1 trillion. Now they're well over $2 trillion. They've revised their estimate. But I'm wondering why we can't look at a flat tax like a 10% across the board, including those people who under the Bush tax cuts are that 50% who no longer pay taxes. They don't have any skin in this game. The 10% would have the richer paying more, middle class paying their fair share, and the bottom class, even if we wanted to reduce it to 5%, let them have some skin in this game.
All right, let's let everybody respond. I think Art talked about Steve Forbes in the last segment about that's something that Steve Forbes wanted. It went nowhere. It's been discussed for umpteen years.
Well, that's the point. It's been around for many years,
right.
Academics.
But it never goes anywhere.
We can philosophically come up with idea and equity, but that's right. It never goes anywhere. On the other hand, closing loopholes – partly because they're called that, deductions. Reagan and Tip O'Neill in particular, but also Daschle and Democratic senators were able to work out significant revenue increases. Reagan raised taxes about 12 times by closing loopholes. And that should be, I think, the approach that Washington can take and get it done.
Joanne, I want to ask you, are you still on the line, Joanne?
Yes, I am.
I want to ask you a question. Do you receive any government benefits of any kind?
I'm a federal retiree. I get a pension check, but that's not a benefit I put into that.
Okay, so you worked on it. But let's talk about how realistic it is that people want to give something up. And let's talk about, you know, what really happened on Election Day. Now, granted, they heard Barack Obama say, you know, speech in, speech out, that the wealthiest Americans should be willing to give a little bit more. And he won the election. Fair and square, it was debated. And so you've got to say, okay, the American people like that idea of not necessarily soaking the rich, but taxing the rich a little bit more. From a political standpoint, Nick, is that a position that the Republicans want to be stuck with again in the next election? Because even Bill Kristol, who is one of the most conservative of all conservatives, said, why are we falling on the sword for this group of people that, you know, they vote with us, but they're killing us in elections?
Well, I think that's something that they're, quote unquote, willing to look at. I mean, you heard it from the speaker saying that that we're willing to look at revenues. The only thing that we keep hearing about is the 2%. I think there's some strength behind the Grover Norquist tax pledge, and I think some Republicans are willing to kind of look at that. And what sword they're willing to die on, I think that's unclear.
Mike, what do you think?
When you look at progressivity, I happen to be philosophically, I agree with the idea of a flat tax. I just know it's never going to happen. So I just, it's in a fantasy world.
Right.
It's not in a real world. But in terms of the rich paying more and more, the one thing is people are confusing the idea of what the current marginal rates are. And if you compare them to much of the world, our current marginal rates are low.
Yeah.
You want to look at what do people pay, what does, say, a group of people, the top 10% pay of the total amount of taxes received. And based upon that metric, looking at it in terms of who pays taxes, we are the most progressively taxed people in the world, because our richest 1%, 5%, 10%, 25%, 30%, keep going down, pay more taxes than anybody else in the world. And when you take a look at the bottom, now part of this would be, for example, that earned income tax credit you were saying was such a wonderful program, which I happen to agree completely. Even under a flat tax, you would not begin to pay any tax because of deductions of for the number of people in your household and so forth until about $40,000 of income. Only then would you pay these flat rates, and we would have to get rid of all the deductions.
I want to go back to the question, Joanne. I'm going to ask you, are you still on the line?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and we're going to move on. And that is the other part of this that we discussed at the very beginning, and that is, okay, the voters vote for Barack Obama for another 4 years. Those same people, in many cases, they vote to send a Republican House back, which is the more conservative of the two bodies of Congress. And so when they send them back, they obviously like what they're doing. They're standing in the way. They are standing in the schoolhouse door, if you will, for Barack Obama, and they're saying, Mr. President, no, we're not going to let you raise our taxes. Now, this, how you expect your president to give you what you think he's going to give you, and how you expect that your Republican member of Congress is going to give you what you want them, that's why we have this stalemate. There's no easy answer here because people want something for nothing.
And exactly, and a large majority of those people not paying taxes or getting something for nothing, such as the food stamps and all the other giveaways, are the ones who voted Barack Obama in. They're not the ones who are affected by the taxes.
The only one thing I'm going to add, Joanne, is that the rate you quote, 10%, sounds sweet, but my understanding is even Forbes, when looking at what would raise enough money to run this government, 17 was the number. Mm-hmm. You could not go below 17.
We're moving on to Dave in Sacramento, California, listening to us on KTKZ. Go ahead, California. Nice to hear from you tonight.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I have two things I'd like to talk about. The first to me is around the capital gains tax. To me, the income tax is a bit of a red herring in that most people that are wealthy make their money off of capital gains. And I find it interesting that the capital gains tax, putting it at 20% or 15%, if we were in 1980, when everybody was 100% invested in U.S. stocks and bonds, makes sense. Today, most people are invested, particularly the very wealthy, are invested at best 30 to 40% in U.S. stocks and bonds. The rest is spread around the world, emerging markets and places like that. Why are we giving them a preferable tax to invest in China and get returns? They should be paying regular income tax on that money. It's just ridiculous that we're charging them 15% for investing in China.
All right, let's let Mark Witte tackle that one first, and then we'll get Mike's response.
Well, two things. One is with the Reagan 86 tax reform, that it was a move to tax basically all income at the same rate, which was a great simplification for the tax code. And Warren Buffett actually has pushed for all income beyond a certain level to be taxed at the same rate. And so there's some attraction to that, but then there's a lot of thought that it creates a lot of economic inefficiency to tax investment income.
Exactly right. The idea that people are foregoing consumption today so that others can take their entrepreneurial talent, fund it, and create new jobs and so forth, that's why we have these advantages for capital gains and even for dividends. And the problem, for example, even with capital gains, you're making a gain on a company that has already been taxed 35% marginal rate on its corporate income tax. And the same would be true of dividends. And if we raise the dividend rate to equal normal income, the money's been taxed twice, once at 35, and if you're really rich, once at 43. So we're talking an enormous amount of money being taken by the government. There's no incentive to continue to invest.
1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we're going to ask the question, okay, what happens if we go off the fiscal cliff? How are you affected? What's the first thing you're going to notice? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont, you're going to be hearing a lot about the big deal in Washington, D.C. It's got to be done by the end of the year. If that deal does not happen, there will be across-the-board cuts in domestic and military programs, immediate tax increases for all Americans, the result of the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts. They would take effect in January, so less than a month from now. Together, the automatic spending cuts and tax increases would cut the deficit by fiscal year 2013 by more than $500 billion. That is an amount so sudden and large that some economists say that it would cause a recession. I want to get reaction from our guests to that. The goal of both the president and Congress allegedly is a package of alternative spending cuts and revenue increases. And the most important thing they want to be able to say is we protected our base and those guys are bad. So everybody, both sides are going to be saying that. First of all, do you agree that if we go off the cliff, do you believe and the speed with which these cuts would be made, do you agree, Mark, that a recession is imminent?
Well, so if we go off the cliff and stay off the cliff, I think, well, this according to the Economic Policy Institute, people making $1 million and up will see about $250,000 tax hike, which would be about 11% of their income. Their tax will go up by 11% over what they are now. And for people making like 40 to 50, it would be about a 1,700 hike, and that's about a 4.4% of their income. But tax cuts can be retroactive, so there's plenty of time to sort of take this back.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go with the CBO, which you mentioned earlier. They argue that we would fall into a recession in the first half of the year. Not deep, but it would be a recession. Unemployment would go from the current 7.8 to 9.1. We've already said that lack of jobs is one of the reasons we don't have enough revenue. almost any one of the things that are in the cliff by itself would not be that terrible. But when you add in the fact that the ATM is going to go and now all of a sudden hit 30 million additional people, and you add in capital gains and dividends and the marriage penalty and the sequestration, and all rates across the board go up.
And the payroll tax.
And the payroll tax goes up 2 percentage points. When you add all that together, you take multipliers times multipliers, and it's a disaster waiting
to
happen.
So the answer to my question before the break, for those listening and watching the show this evening, the first thing that they're going to notice is with their paycheck in January, the payroll taxes are going to be higher.
They would get less. They'll have to pay 2 percentage points more in terms of Social Security, and every marginal tax rate will rise, so they will pay more on their federal income tax as well. So there's no doubt that every single working person will be paying more money starting on January 1st.
Now, part of this is the automatic spending cuts. This is called the sequester plan. And these are things that will automatically take place because Republicans and Democrats in Congress could not agree on where the cuts would be. So they're going to make it automatic, and it's going to have a significant impact. But there's a lot of conservatives, Nick, that they say, you know what? This is a good idea. Government can't figure it out. Let's just have automatic cuts. What's wrong with that idea, or what's right with it as you see it?
Well, I don't think automatic cuts are going to solve any problems other than cause a frenzy. I do think, though, getting back to the point of the payroll tax.
But it would cut spending, right?
Sure, it would cut spending.
So it would cut spending.
It would cut spending in a variety of areas.
So some conservatives might like that idea.
They might like that idea. But I think the thing is the people that are employed that are going to be paying more, I just want to get to this point, is that the people that have been getting jobs, a lot of them are underemployed, and so they barely are making it as it is if they are making it, and just an additional increases like this are enough to make that more difficult to rely more on the government cuts that are taking effect.
Art Sear, what about sequestering to you? Can it be a good idea?
No, I don't think it's a good idea, and I think there would be a tremendous public backlash because the people, for all the frustrations of government,
but that's what they voted for.
Sure.
People voted for, they voted for a Democratic president. They voted for Republican House.
No,
they couldn't agree, and so they're sequestering because they couldn't agree before. What's wrong with that?
Just to finish the point, Congress has to act or the people will react. And if these automatic cuts, which the Congress voted for at the last minute last year, go into effect, I think there will be a huge public backlash.
So what will the public do?
Bruce,
they've got 2 years before they can vote.
If I may please just finish the point.
Okay.
Congressmen are very much like college students. At 5 minutes to midnight, you pull an all-nighter, you get it done just as the sun is rising. I'm joking, but it's actually very true. These are extremely difficult decisions. I'm convinced that Congress and the White House will act. The Congressional Budget Office, I'm very glad we have one. It's fairly new. The earlier caller made a very good point. It's highly politicized. In that they're constantly changing. Unlike OMB and the old Bureau of the Budget, which was disciplined, strict, and enforced the president's will in the executive branch, they've disappeared completely, especially in the Obama administration. So I think Congress will do something, but I'm much more concerned about the indiscipline, especially in the Obama administration, concerning spending.
Mike?
One thing, there's been some new work to figure out since austerity has really taken hold in Europe, as well as what some people want to do here, which is more damaging, to raise taxes in austerity as a way of getting a deficit smart, or cutting spending. And according to the research that they did, cutting spending is less damaging. Raising taxes is more damaging. But there's one thing about it. Half of the sequestration comes out of one department. It comes out of defense. And I happen to be strong on defense. I know there's got to be lots of waste in defense. But just think of all the people who are going to get pink slips in the defense industry. So who's going to be affected by sequestration? A huge number of people in the United States in the defense industry.
Art Sear,
those defense industries aren't going to get the pink slips. Active duty personnel. It's not the big weapons makers, but the guys, the women and men on the front line, they're going to be even more stressed, more suicides, more mental illness. They're the ones who pay the price, not
benefit
the big
cuts.
Guys. Oh, absolutely.
Everybody's going to have a benefit cut.
The military, it's an extremely important point. The military-industrial complex will survive, but our military personnel will suffer greatly. And that's a point that's never discussed. I'm very glad to have the opportunity to make it.
And when we come back, if you're listening to this program on radio, we're going to continue with another hour. We're going to pick up on that particular point because, again, there's a lot of people perhaps cheering the idea of sequestering. That's a good idea. They can't figure it out.
Oh,
if you are one of those people, give us a call at 1-800-723-8029. The professors will all be back for the next hour. And again, if you're watching this show on television, you can only imagine what we're about to talk about. But who knows? Maybe someday we'll carry the full 2 hours on television. You never know. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us this week. And if you're going to stick with us on radio, we'll be back after the news. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway tonight, featuring commentary by Art Sear, director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business at Carthage College, Mike Miller, associate professor of the Department of Economics at DePaul University, Mark Witte, distinguished senior lecturer in the Department of Economics at Northwestern University, and Nick Kacharubis, visiting assistant professor at DePaul University. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. We've been talking about what is likely to happen if the country goes off the fiscal cliff. And before we take a call, and we will take a call, we've got a call waiting in Texas that we will go to in just a moment. But I just want to go around the table and get everybody's sort of prediction as to what you think is likely to happen. Nick, we'll start with you. Look into your crystal ball.
I have to agree with Art that I think that they will come to compromise at the last minute, but they'll punt it down the road. And I think the point I've been trying to make, and I should have made it earlier, is that I don't know why anyone isn't looking at capitalism and entrepreneurship and the creation of jobs as a long-term solution. That's what's got us out of World War II and our production. And I think that's the long-term solution, and I wish that would be addressed.
Mike Miller?
I think 6 months ago I said the same thing. I think that there will be some kind of higher revenues generated from the richest, and it will either be through deductions or a rate. And this is what will buy the tax kept the same for the rest of the Americans. And then they'll spend the next calendar year trying to actually come up with a sane tax policy.
Art Sear?
Naturally, I'm glad one of your other guests brought up World War II. Every decade on average since World War II, our economy, our GNP, has doubled in nominal terms. Even in the stagflation of the 70s, we had real growth. We were looking at deficits as far as the eye could see in the 80s, but by the 90s we were looking at surpluses as far as the eye could see.
So what happens?
I think that we will continue to grow, and the Congress will put a Band-Aid avoiding the worst of the
kick the cataclysm. Can down the road.
No. As I say, we will grow out of this as we always have. I do believe very strongly that income concentration in this country is a very, very serious problem. The top 2% now provide an enormous share of total income tax income. I think that's very bad because it shows just how wealth has become concentrated since the 60s.
Mark Witte?
Well, this is a manufactured crisis. There's nothing real here. I mean, you look at long-term rates on government debt, they're incredibly low.
Yeah.
You know, we're a very low-tax country.
Manufactured by whom for what purpose?
I think journalists like it. You know, it sells a lot of papers. You know, politicians grandstanding. But you look
nothing
at
nothing sells papers anymore.
Well, a lot of web clicks or something, yeah. But, you know, you look at what long-term rates are. You look at what markets really say. There really is not a problem with the U.S.'s credibility with, you know, borrowing this money. In the long run, yeah, rates are going to go up. And I think actually in the short run, when the Bush tax cuts, you know, when they run out at the end of the year, they're going to go up. There'll be some, you know, something will be worked out to see that rates below, say, 200,000 go back to what they were before. And, yeah, there'll probably be some spending cuts. The real question is what's going to happen with the debt ceiling. Will there be a fix on that?
Well, one of the suggestions was that it should be automatic, that Congress should give up that right. That doesn't seem to be going anywhere, but that was something that proposed by the administration.
Yes, they did. Interesting that the president would ask that the House give up its power over the purse. I think that that's a silly thing to do. I think fighting over the debt ceiling is silly. But asking the House to give up that power is sillier than that even. I don't get it.
The power of the purse is the power to propose
tax.
And tax. The debt ceiling is not that.
No, but the idea is if you would put a limit on it, then you have to somehow raise the revenue or you have to cut spending, and therefore the House is going to be key. And I don't think the House is going to give up any power.
Do you think on the area of automatic elements, the Simpson-Bowles Commission came out. They came out with recommendations. They were put on a shelf. They've been talked about, and nothing's really happened with them. And again, last year when they were trying to come up with the big deal, or I guess it was earlier this year, they came up with the plan that there's going to be this sequestering plan. Is there some way that there could be bipartisan agreement that when the deficit in the future gets to a particular point, automatic things go into place so that you wouldn't have to necessarily have this back and forth between the political parties, and there would be an automatic governor on the ability or the increase? Is that a good idea?
Why don't we just have a dictator? I'm not being sarcastic or funny. Dictatorships used to be very attractive for that reason. Fortunately, they're not so much anymore because they don't work over the long term in terms of satisfying the people or providing justice. Representative government is sloppy. It's difficult. It's very easy to be irresponsible when you're very rich, but it's essential to our system. You're not going to have efficient democracy. It's an oxymoron.
Nick, what do you think of that idea?
I don't think it would work. I think you can say it sounds good and we'll have these parameters in place, but every situation is different. And I don't see the Republican Congress saying, okay, well, we're going to, at least with a Democratic president, saying, well, we're going to agree to these provisions in the future. I think they want to hold it.
Don in Round Lock, Texas. Are you there listening to us on KLBJ? Don, are you there? I think Don, are you there?
I'm here now.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
For your discussion, you guys talked about a couple things. One is that the tax increase on the wealthy you're talking about is $1 trillion or so over 10 years, which is about $100 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
We are facing a deficit of $1 trillion a year, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe you could talk about how all these tax increases they're talking about are really just a drop in a bucket or rearranging the deck chairs on a Titanic. And second, talk about baseline budgeting. And if I understand correctly, the stimulus, because of baseline budgeting, has now been built into the budget. I seem to remember that the budget roughly doubled between 2008 and 2009.
Mm-hmm. Mark Whitty, you want to comment on that?
Well, no, the stimulus is largely phased out.
But Obama's proposed another one.
The Geithner one that got leaked out, there certainly is a stimulus proposal in there. And that is appropriate because we've got unemployment of 7.9% and that we actually need stimulus more than we need austerity.
Wow. You must admit as an economist, it's pretty pathetic that 3.5 years after the trough of the business cycle, we're talking stimulus packages because everything is so weak, which of course shows that the president was focused upon Obamacare and redistribution, not economic growth. Here we are this far into the business cycle, and we're talking stimulus. We also know that when you try to do stimulus through government spending this late in the business cycle, that it has a multiplier that is very, very low. You have a large multiplier only when you have a bunch of idle resources sitting around in the depths of a recession.
7.9% unemployment.
Well, but that's the only place we have it. We don't have people. These entrepreneurs need the money, and if the government's taking it all out of the system, they can't have it.
How are people going to respond to a stimulus? Are they going to sit by the Republican House, the leadership, the Tea Party folks within the Republican Party? I mean, the idea of another stimulus to them. I mean, they got to go apoplectic.
I don't think it's going anywhere. I mean, we did it 3 years ago and it didn't work. And why would they walk down that path again now?
It absolutely worked.
A quick answer. Do you think the way that Geithner and the president are handling the situation right now, Art, do they really want to make a deal, or do they first and foremost want to flex their muscles to their base and want to send a political signal first? That's the question. We're going to get your answer after we break. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Lots of callers. When we come back, we're going to answer those questions, take a few more calls, and then talk about Benghazi and talk about Israel and talk about a state for Palestine. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Art, my question to you is, right at this particular moment, are the Democrats, specifically the president and his Treasury Secretary, are they the use of the words and the rhetoric that they're doing now in this proposal that came out last week, which is sort of a rehash of something they've done before, do you think that they really want to get this thing resolved quickly, or do they want to hold on to the issue and look strong for the constituents group that elected them?
The latter. I think they want to hold on to the issue and play politics for a while.
Does everybody agree with that?
As of January 20th, the Democrats have a lot more votes in Congress. They can broker a better deal.
Yeah, but they still don't have the House. Even if they have more votes in the House, they don't have the House. So
does everyone agree with what Art says? Mm-hmm. I mean, right at this moment, the battle of words right now is Obama being able to say over and over again, listen, you wanted to raise taxes on the richest Americans. We're going to do that. I'm going to do it. This is what we're going to do. And we're not, so that when Geithner goes on TV, he says those rates are going to have to go up. That's an essential part of a deal. That was, to me, the strongest thing he said today.
That's an essential part of muscle flexing. We now have complete mm-hmm. agreement around the table. Bruce, you may ask your next question.
And it is.
No, they're not interested in a deal right now.
Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. They've always got ideas down there. Dan, listening to us on WAPI. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. One of the things that I haven't heard, and it's to me it's somewhat disingenuous to when they worked out this deal and the sequestration. My understanding that there really isn't a lot of danger to the country, particularly on these defense cuts that would be made in the sequestration. So if their only reason that they want to postpone these cuts is for jobs, that seems like it's working against the American public and really against the spirit of reducing the deficit. And I am a Republican, obviously, and it's coming from where I am, but not necessarily everybody here is that way. But on the other hand, and I'm very conservative about our military readiness. But I just don't understand if they were deemed worthy to be cut, then why shouldn't they be cut? And then the other comment
Dan, hang on one second. I'm going to let you make your second comment, but let's delve into your first comment, because at the end of our last hour, Art Sear was making a point, and we had agreement on it during the break. He was talking about some of the devastating aspects of sequestration as it relates to the military. So, Art, for those that have just tuned in, give us a summary and then expand on Dan's point. He's thinking that maybe it isn't going to be such a bad deal.
Congress didn't look in detail at these matters. They simply said arbitrarily at the last minute, we're going to have arbitrary, very severe cuts in the budget. I mentioned the Office of Management and Budget before. They're never discussed nowadays. That's the president's instrument for careful and sensible cutting. In the Defense Department especially, which is an enormous enterprise, as everyone knows, the point I was trying to make was that weapon systems will certainly be favored over personnel, which are already stretched thin and suffering. So I think it's a recipe for a really serious disaster.
Mike Miller?
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, there's the thing about this whole cliff, you're talking about the cuts and sequestration. Of course, every household's going to face this as well. The one difference is that you and I in a household, we kind of know where the fat is. We know the things that we do that we don't really have to do, and we will cut only those things we need to. I'm just afraid in government that the cuts will be made politically instead of efficiency-wise, and who knows what's going
to
happen.
But to follow up on what Art just said, Art said that the missile defense systems, the contractors, they will be hurt less than the troops. Isn't there? Wouldn't there be a bipartisan cry that the troops be dealt with less severely than some of the new missile programs, Nick?
I would think that that would be the administration's interest in doing that, but it's not guaranteed. I mean, when you put things in there and arbitrarily cut, if it's on a list, I don't think you can necessarily control those
things. Dan, response to you.
Well, you just hit, I mean, this is pathetic that we have a Congress and a Senate that would come up with something like this. And we can't sit there, and I mean, I really respect all of your panel, and I go out of my way to listen every Sunday, that we can't say what they actually are. You know what I'm saying? Is it a certain aircraft, or is it, you know, I mean, without giving away, of course, classified information, that we can't say exactly where what this would be? I mean, and the mayor thought that they would just systematically, without examining what they're cutting, go. I mean, the one thing, and I don't praise the president or his party very much, but this idea of cutting farm subsidies. If that was first on the sequestration, my goodness, you've got record high farm income. Why is there even farm subsidies? I mean, I don't want to get off onto that, but I mean, you can't sit and tell people what's being cut. I mean, do you realize how pathetic that is?
No, I agree with you that, but again, you know, when they were at the fiscal cliff last year, no one could agree on, you know, on what had to be cut. So they had to come to this.
And let's follow up on Art's point is that, some of it's going to be in the form of cutting soldiers, and they come back, they won't necessarily have jobs because the economy is so weak. But also, as I remember the start of the Iraq War, I say after the Afghanistan War, so many of our men and women were killed because of these devices that blow up on the side of the road, and the deal was that their vehicles were not armored against this.
Right.
And Bush was attacked of, why didn't you spend more money on this? And these are some of the same people now saying, well, we should take more money from the military. If I knew for sure it was going to maybe get rid of some inefficiency or some armament that they don't need or whatever, I think that would be fine. But if it's going to cut people and it's going to cut their supplies that keep them alive, I just – knowing what's going to be cut, I think, is very important.
Tom in Elgin, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking the call. There's a few things that I wanted to address. One of them being, and I'm hearing this more and more on all talk radio shows, and that is that people that are on food stamps, people that are getting unemployment, want to be that way. Man, I'll tell you, anybody that wants to talk about it, I'll be happy to meet them out in the alley. I don't like where I'm at. I don't like the position. I want to be out working. But I hate to bring this idea to America's attention. There is a thing called age discrimination. While there's laws in place, you know what? Try bringing it to court. Try bringing it to anyone's attention. They don't care. Congress created this mess so I and many other men and women can't find jobs. Yet we never see them giving up anything, their free lunches, free health care, the swimming pool, all the other stuff that they're entitled to. I live a few doors away from a retired senator. I know what those guys get, and none of them are giving up anything. I went to get food stamps, and in the office it said, getting food stamps is patriotic. What? I never heard of such stupidity in my life. But this is the propaganda that Obama's people have been putting out, and the Republicans sit back and say, that's fine. What the Republicans need to do is get a good PR machine in place, a good media machine in place, and tell the truth. But you know what? They don't do it either. Can you tell I'm mad, fellas?
No.
Well, what is the truth you want them to tell?
What I would like them to do is come out and tell where these monies that they will not, where the money is going that they're spending. There's a project going down right now in the Ozarks, and if I mention it on the radio, you guys will come and lock me up. But there are several projects going on now, one in the Ozarks, where they're building underground bunkers with our money. It was on TV. It can be seen on the Internet. There's all kinds of pet projects going on all over the country. But what do we talk about? Oh, let's talk about cutting extensions on unemployment. That's not going to make a dent. You know it.
Yeah, one thing that I know that when people look at food stamps, we hear that there's more people on food stamps than ever. My understanding is part of that is because of how many people above the poverty line now receive those food stamps. They've changed it such that you're entitled to it even like 1.5 to 2 times the poverty rate or something to that effect. And you begin to wonder that maybe food stamps will never go away because it's a farm subsidy, if nothing else. But certainly for people in poverty, the idea of food stamps, I would think that no one around this table, no one I've ever spoken to, which I consider to be conservative, has ever thought that this is something that you would take away from people. But also remember what Milton Friedman one time said about spending by government. You're spending other people's money on other people. And in that situation, you concern yourself neither with price nor with quality. And one problem with government is it just doesn't know how to spend money compared to a corporation or to households.
Art's here.
One point to keep in mind is I think what the caller was mainly communicating was a lot of passion, which we can hear and I think we should all think about very, very seriously. The government has a limited impact on the economy. It has an important impact in terms of regulation. It has a vital impact in terms of helping the very poor. But when we get passionate about politicians, we assume that Washington, if it was totally efficient, could have all kinds of impact on our economy. And that, of course, is not true. What you need, FDR's genius was people, the vast majority believed him. I believe he staved off a very violent revolution, especially in his first term. But what we need is leaders who are seen as believable, credible. That's the most important thing.
How is Wall Street responding to what's happening in Washington, D.C.? And what connectivity is that? How are those connected, Mark?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about what the fiscal cliff will do on January 1st or something like that. And I think it'll be very minor. And if there is a big movement in the markets, I think it'll be a buying opportunity.
But there are some firms that are issuing dividends this year so that their people don't face the higher income tax rates next year.
They don't love Obama anymore. They gave their big money to the Romney campaign. The love affair is over, in case you hadn't heard.
1-800-723-8289. When we come back, we're talking foreign affairs. Back shortly. Bruce DeMont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Nice to have you with us around the table this evening. Art Sear is here. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at the Clawson Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Mark Witte is here. He is a distinguished senior lecturer at Northwestern University in the Department of Economics. Also in the Department of Economics as an assistant professor at DePaul University is Mike Miller. And Nick Kacharubas also joins us. He is a visiting professor at DePaul University. And we're going to switch gears now, and we're going to talk a little bit about everything that's happening in the Middle East, specifically what's been happening with Israel and Palestinian situation. The Palestinian president returned triumphantly to the West Bank on Sunday. He received a boisterous welcome from thousands of cheering supporters at a rally celebrating the people's new acceptance to the United Nations. You know, the United Nations voted overwhelmingly to support a state of Israel. Or not a state of a Palestinian state, not the state of Israel. Take that vote back.
That was a few decades ago.
That's right. He would not have received a rousing welcome had he done that. But it was specifically about the vote recently in the UN, and also the reaction to Israel wanting now to beef up and expand the building of settlements, which has been frowned upon by the United States, by the Department of State as well. And even Hillary Rodham Clinton has said that the Palestinians have missed multiple opportunities for peacemaking, but the Israelis have shown a lack of empathy for the problems of the Palestinians. So, again, the problem is getting muckier and muckier every single week. Art Sear, you're our foreign policy guru at the table this evening. How should the world and how should Americans read the UN vote on a Palestinian state?
I think it's a benchmark. It shows how isolated Israel is, but that's also nothing new. So to me, it simply reinforces the status quo in the UN General Assembly. U.S. leadership historically is vital in the Middle East. I'm not at all sure that the current situation is worse than in the past. In some ways, it's better. I think the second term is an opportunity. From my point of view, it's essential for President Obama to show presidential leadership, and the Middle East is a good place for him to do that. We have tremendous leverage. Israel has great influence in this country, but two-thirds of all our foreign aid go to Egypt and Israel, two principal players in the current constellation. American presidents who've made real progress have been often at odds with Israel, and taken actions that are unpopular. First President Bush and Secretary of State James Baker carried the peace process notably further, although ultimately it was frustrated. Jimmy Carter, who doesn't get as much respect as he deserves, brokered a Camp David peace accord in 79 that still holds between Egypt and Israel. Most important leadership was provided by Ike during the Suez Crisis of 56, by far the most important and serious crisis in the region involving us. And in each case, Israel was hostile to American action. In each case, American leadership was vindicated. So it's the ball is in Obama's court, not the UN, not Palestine, not Israel.
UN leadership has said earlier today that if Israel implements its latest plan for new settlements, it would deal, quote, an almost fatal blow to any prospects for peace with the Palestinians. Again, in the wake of the UN vote, Israel announced about 3,000 Jewish settler homes would be planned and located in the area that is of dispute. What is your reaction to Israel's reaction to the UN vote?
It's a very bad idea, which is why I mentioned the crises in earlier periods where the U.S. took on Israel's leadership very directly and prevailed. This is a good opportunity for President Obama, who I don't believe has been a strong president. I voted for him. I think there are many great things about having him in the White House, but he has not been an assertive, strong president as far as I can tell.
Nick, what is your personal opinion as to whether or not there should be a Palestinian state?
Personally, I'm not in favor of it at this point. I think that in the future, that could be something that can be seen, but I do agree with the Secretary Clinton's statement in the sense that there have been opportunities to forge peace and have not been taken up, and so I have a little bit of trouble with that.
Mike Miller,
I guess I'm the only thing is I'm floored that they have recognized a state where they don't. I actually the article I can't remember where it was, a Wall Street Journal or somewhere, it listed what do you have to be a state, and they don't have any of them, like maybe two of them.
Right.
So they aren't really a state. They refuse to recognize the right of existence of the country right beside them. They want to destroy them and drive them into the Mediterranean. I just think this is just so odd. I think a two-state solution is the answer, but
no.
Not the way they're doing it.
Do they, given their rhetoric, should we as Americans, should we sometimes step back from what leaders of political parties say around the world, whether it's Ahmadinejad, whether it is the Palestinians, whether it was Nikita Khrushchev, he was going to bury us. I mean, can we look at some of the bellicose rhetoric of world leaders and say, you know what, this is for their politics. They say crazy things just like we have politicians that say crazy things. But let's not keep reminding everybody that they don't think Israel has a right to exist. Maybe when they can say that, but maybe they don't really mean it. Or if they really mean it, they don't really believe that it's going to happen.
But they wrote it down. Am I correct that it's in the Hamas charter for the destruction of the state of Israel? We're not talking about somebody just huffing and puffing. I understand. I was barely alive when Khrushchev was doing that stuff.
But there are things in the Republican and Democratic platform that have been put in every 4 years that, again, wouldn't stand the test of practicality.
Well, I would not sit across this table with any of the four of you if you didn't recognize my right to exist. I'm sorry. I would walk away from the table.
Mark, your response.
Well,
so people can hear you.
What would Woodrow Wilson say?
I don't know.
Do people have the right to self-determination? But then I think of Anthony Lake, who talked about the frustrations of working with Yasser Arafat, and that Lake looks back and says that he feels he failed to set a variety of, like a sequence of tests for Arafat to, get used to going to his people and saying, well, we've made a lot of broad claims, but here we're going to have to compromise in this small thing and see how that goes over, and then this small thing. And until you sort of get that process worked in, like you say, like a normal political process where people, want certain things but learn to settle for less, it is hard to see how the end game will play out.
Yeah, and he never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity, I think is what they also said about Arafat.
Yeah.
And I'm neither Arab nor Israeli, Jew or a Muslim, and I just don't
understand.
I'm an economist, and it just seems to me that You can't be lobbing missiles at somebody. You can't put into your charter that you want somebody to die and to go away. You can't be anti-Semitic and everything which they are and try to have a state right next to each other. I just don't get it.
They're also, the Palestinians are dependent, of course, on Israeli economic assistance, and they are on ours as well. Egypt is emerging as a principal player in the region. We have a huge amount of economic leverage. Additionally, demographics are against Israel, and I'm not referring just to gross population size, where the Israelis are increasingly outnumbered. If you're a young Israeli, Netanyahu, when you look at the people around him and you look at his rallies, there are an awful lot of gray heads there. If you're a young person in Israel, you're like young people everywhere, including the college students we deal with. You want to work on your MBA or PhD in that case, or trade financial instruments, or and go to the clubs at night. What you don't want, what you're, they're less and less inclined to do, is put on body armor, pick up exotic small arms, get in armored vehicles, and push Arabs around in the occupied territories. So I think Netanyahu is a last gasp. I hope so. But again, U.S. leadership is crucial.
Well, but again, in this particular case, the United States was not they were one of those that voted against this resolution. I think they were one of nine that voted against it.
The UN doesn't, but the UN doesn't count. And excuse me, but this is really, that's why I keep coming back to the tremendous economic leverage we have over Israel, and to some extent political leverage. There is an Israel lobby, but the Jewish community in this country is extremely diverse as well as influential. And I think there is a real opportunity, especially for a liberal Democrat like Obama, who has very, very strong support from that segment of the population, to have an impact if he'll be a strong president.
Well, also, in the particular case, the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly backed a resolution recognizing Palestine within the 1967 borders as a non-member observer state. That's when the response came from Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. He warned that if they had gone to the United Nations, they were violating previous agreements with Israel, such as the 1993 Oslo Accords, and that his country would act accordingly. Also, in addition to announcing that there was going to be the settlements, which in essence basically cuts in half and divides what's happening on the West Bank and where the Palestinians are living on the West Bank, it divides up their neighborhood or their area, if you will. The finance minister of Israel said today that Israel would not transfer tax and tariff funds it collects for the Palestinians this month. So they are using the power of their purse to provide, and these are funds raised in that area. They're providing and they're pulling the strings on money that should go to the Palestinians.
It's hard to think of a better way for the Israelis further to isolate themselves. It really seems irrational.
I guess I don't think so on that one. I mean, I think that they see this as an aggressive act, and you know, I would imagine that reaction from them is expected. I mean, I'm not saying that someday we're down the road in this idea of self-determination that Palestine shouldn't have a state, but right now in the way that it's going through, I can see that there's a lot of there's always been a hotbed of emotions there, and the reaction isn't unexpected in my opinion.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8289. We'll take more calls. 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border, this is Beyond the Beltway Live every Sunday night from Chicago. From Philadelphia, Mississippi to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Brian, who's listening to us on POTUS tonight on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, and he is calling from the city of Brotherly Love. Brian, nice to have you with us tonight.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. So I tune in a little late. I'm not familiar with everybody's names, but the gentleman who was not understanding Israel's point of view, that I think you mentioned something about everybody had gray hair who still wanted to be aggressive towards the Palestinians, and that the youth would no longer put up with it. I don't understand why he thinks that, because if Canada was acting towards us the way the Palestinians act towards Israel, we would do the same thing. In fact, we do a lot of the same thing. And I guess equivocation is the problem. People like to say that that the aggression of Israel because they occupy the territories is equivalent to the terrorists blowing up bombs. And that doesn't make any sense. So what exactly is it that Israel's doing other than defending themselves that is so bad? There's targeted killings. We do targeted killings. We have drones. So what, I guess I'm trying to figure out, where is it that the Israelis are the aggressors? It doesn't seem that they're the aggressors.
Well, there is a difference between defending yourself, which they have every right to do, and building these new settlements in areas which are supposedly in dispute. I think that was your point, Mart, right? That the disputed areas of coming up with new settlements was the real problem.
I also think that any state that's enormously militarized over a long period of time, there are destructive aspects to that, and it's hard to maintain a democracy, and it's hard for democracy to maintain that.
I think one other thing, Brian, if I can just sort of, you know, make this comparison, is that the world knows that if you strike Israel with missiles, you're going to get hit back big time.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, some might say it's an overreaction, but again, you do something military to Israel, and the world knows they're going to pay for it. In this particular case, we're now looking at the diplomatic muscle and mindset of Israel. Now, in a diplomatic center like the United Nations, they basically, the world came together, and with the exception of nine nations, they ganged up on Israel.
No.
And now you're seeing sort of the diplomatic aspect of Israel responding the same way that they do militarily. Okay, you're going to vote against us, we're going with 2,000 more settlements. And where are we going to put them? We're going to put them in the most contentious area, not the area. So it's basically, it's a one-upsmanship that Israel is using diplomatically, just like we know they do militarily. And they're fighting from a position, is they're fighting for their lives. And a question I would ask to you, Brian, because, again, Art mentioned in the last segment sort of the demographics and the population and sort of the history that maybe is not, at least the future is not numerically on Israel's side. What is your thought about the demographics of the Middle East, the age of the Palestinian population? Is a Palestinian state inevitable for you personally?
Yeah, I would think a Palestinian state is inevitable, not just for me personally. I think it's been inevitable for every Israeli politician that's ever said anything about it. But I think, like another one of your guests has said, you can't have those negotiations until they recognize the person they're supposed to be negotiating with. So the Palestinians recognize Israel and denounce the terrorism. We wouldn't do that. And by the way, you know, you talk about Israel maybe a little overreacting, which I would disagree with. Palestinians have terrorists blow up bombs, blow up innocent civilians, and hurl rockets. So in a sense, you know, when a terrorist attacked the United States with two airplanes, that was less than what the Palestinians are doing in Israel. And I would counter and say that Iraq and Afghanistan were a lot bigger than anything that Israel has done. So, you know, Israel gets painted as overreacting. I got to disagree. I think they react a lot less than we do. And I think that they're well within their rights to do it. And I think that there's a tremendous double standard going on when people look at Israel, because people like the underdog and they just want to see the conflict go away. And I don't think they're paying attention. It makes no sense.
I did not mean to suggest that they overreact. I think there's something that says, you know, okay, you hit me with a hammer, I'll hit you with a sledgehammer. I mean, I think there's something about that response that does make some sense, especially when you are fighting for your survival. You're going to fight harder. You're going to fight, more emphatically when your whole future is at stake. And again, I'm looking at where is there a voice in the Palestinian-Israeli dispute? Where is there a voice? Where is there a leader that is going to say something that is unpopular to his constituency and risk being killed for it? We know what happened to Anwar Sadat. I mean, you know, he tried to do something and he got killed.
Yeah, absolutely the case. And somebody smarter than me one time said, if Israel would put down its arms and say, we will shoot, we will fight no more, they'd be dead in tomorrow. If the Palestinians put down their arms and said, we will not fight, this is the end of it, there'd be two states tomorrow. that there's a completely different philosophy about the existence.
And if the United States turned its back on Israel, there would still be people in the Arab world that would hate the United States, or the Islamic world, not the Arab world.
They'll come up with something.
So it's and it's our responsibility, it seems to me, to continue to protect Israel as best we can. But again, sometimes when you have a friend that you're totally supportive, sometimes your friends do things that make it more difficult.
Oh, sure.
And in this particular case, there was the UN vote. Israel was insulted by it. Israel has they've ratcheted it up on a diplomatic level, and we'll see what happens next week. It won't be solved by next week, I can tell you that. Been doing this show for 32 years. We're still talking about the same subjects. On that note, we are out of time for our broadcast this evening. I thank you very much for joining us. I thank all of our guests as well. Mark Witte from Northwestern University, Art Sear from Carthage College, Mike Miller from DePaul University, Nick Kacharoulis, also from DePaul University. We thank you all for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next Sunday night at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.